and welcome to Sit for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. Hard to believe we're already in September, but here at SIPFA, things are ramping up in anticipation of the upcoming release of the Redmond Review, the Spending Review, and our annual conference in October, which is taking place this year from the 19th of October, and will be going all digital for the very first time. So for more information on the conference, there will be a link in the description. All that aside, we've got a really interesting episode lined up for you this week. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Ileana Steccolini, Professor of Accounting at Essex Business School and member of SIPFA's International Advisory Panel, on public sector resilience and her research in this area. But first, we'll be kicking off with a return visit from SIPFA's Chief Economist, Jeff Matsu, and his reflections on the latest OBR stats on the UK's economic recovery in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm here with Jeffrey Matsu, Chief Economist from SIPFA. How are you doing today, Jeff?
Fine, thank you.
How are you finding lockdown in the summer heat, the glorious summer weather?
It's a good time of the year to be locked down, to be able to enjoy the sunshine and fresh air compared to being in an air-conditioned office. So can't complain, enjoying it.
I'm not going to lie, I kind of miss the air conditioning. That is definitely not something that we have shelled out for in my house.
You won't be saying that once winter rolls around.
This is very true. So Jeff is here with us today to talk us through some of the recent OBR stats from their most recent figures. So Jeff, some of the most recent OBR figures have indicated that 2020 will see the worst economic performance in 300 years. So what's underpinning that prediction?
So growth has really been quite weak, and a lot of that has been due to a self-imposed lockdown by government. So unlike previous recessions that are often triggered by some type of shock, for example, in the great financial crisis 10 years ago, that was led by a housing shock. This one, it's a public health crisis, but the lockdown, the economic repercussions has been due to the lockdown imposed by government. And that has, for the good part of the second quarter of this year, locked down substantial parts of the economy, where just a lot of stuff that normally happens across both goods and services simply wasn't allowed to happen. And that led to a 25% decrease over the past 3 months, reported by the ONS. And for the year as a whole, the OBR is expecting 12% negative growth in GDP in the UK. We haven't seen such negative growth for several decades. And so this is quite significant. And coming through that is just the shutdown across a broad swathe of sectors and industries. And also in particular, a lot of jobs were furloughed. This has a significant cost that will be borne by future generations. But we're not out of the woods yet. And so while the negative impacts have been substantial, a second or subsequent waves of the virus will layer on additional negative impacts as well.
Okay. I mean, during the initial proper lockdown, we kept hearing during the daily press conference briefings about some form of V-shaped recovery. And I know in the analysis that you've done, that sort of V-shape is less likely to be quite so V-like. So can you talk me through some of the main issues that are impacting the economy's ability to bounce back from that shock?
The consensus now is that the recovery isn't going to be V-shaped, just because the way that we're recovering, the way that the economy is recovering, still has a lot of uncertainties, primarily because we still don't know how many of the people who've been furloughed will be reemployed, not just during the transition period that runs till January, using the government's new fiscal support to transition furloughed workers back into the workforce. But by January, that support will be gone. And at that point, only then will we know how many workers are truly going to be unemployed. So for a V-shaped recovery, you need more certainty. We don't have that certainty today, and we won't have it for a few months, to say the least. And so this is a real struggle for households to spend more. Households aren't going to spend more of the savings they've accrued over the past few months, simply because they don't know what their job prospects are. Even if you have a job, will you still have one in a few months' time? That's unclear. In terms of businesses aren't investing in terms of capital expenditure because the outlook is just too uncertain. It's unsure what market demand will be. It's unclear what supply channels will be like. And even before coronavirus, businesses were very reluctant to invest simply because of Brexit risks. And all of that is still in tow. The Brexit deadline is at the end of this year. And so we will see a potential confluence of two fairly sizable risk factors, the first one being second or subsequent waves of coronavirus, and the second uncertainty and substantial risk will be a hard Brexit. And we shouldn't discount either of those two. And that is what will change the contours of the recovery away from V-shaped.
So public spending has naturally been unusually high to help mitigate the impact of the coronavirus. As we're moving away from lockdown, obviously we've seen local lockdowns, we've seen people who are shielding remaining concerned about the health impacts that coronavirus may have. There is news only today about some people who are shielding being concerned that they're going to have to choose between their livelihoods and their health. So do you see this increase in public spending as something that's set to continue? I'm assuming that can't be sustainable in the long term.
In the near term, it is something that I feel government should continue to do, in the sense that we're nowhere near out of the woods yet. If you unwind the fiscal supports too soon and you don't get across the bridge to a more sustainable economic recovery, then it undoes the purpose of what the initial fiscal stimulus package was designed to do. And so if you cut it short too soon, it really may backfire and you may have significant long-term scarring. And what we mean by this is that when people enter a long-term phase of structural unemployment, it really reduces their productive capacity, which would benefit the broader economy. And it also creates a deterioration in their overall skill sets. And it makes it that much more difficult for people who have been unemployed for, say, a year or more to find subsequent employment at comparable levels of pay and seniority as previous to their unemployment. And so it's really important that government tries to avoid a situation where unemployment gets too high. And right now, it's assumed that 15% of furloughed workers will be made redundant. That's a significant number of people that will be made redundant. And we really need to try to avoid this outcome. So as I said, we're not out of the woods yet. We have spent a lot. It would put all of that spending into question if government reins in the spending too soon before a sustainable economic recovery manifests. And so it's really, really important to not just keep blasting out a lot of fiscal support. I think in this stage of the recovery, there needs to be more targeted interventions, which means identifying which sectors, which segments of the economy in terms of demographics such as age, gender, income, which of these groups have been most negatively impacted, which one of those groups are still being impacted, and making sure that public spending is targeted specifically to those groups and less to others.
So you touched there on the predictions around unemployment, and you mentioned slightly earlier that we're unlikely to kind of see what the full impact is as far as the unemployment level is going to be for a number of months yet. But in some of your analysis, you've talked about the correlation between employment rates, chronic health conditions, and welfare spending. So can you walk me through that a bit?
Sure. So employment and chronic health conditions are inversely correlated, as you said. Studies have shown that a 1% fall in the former can lead to a 2% increase in the latter. So based on the OBR's estimate in its fiscal sustainability report, it shows that 1.3 billion people will become unemployed, as I said previously, that 15% estimate, and that would translate to additional welfare spending to the tune of approximately £4 billion annually. It's really important to keep in mind also who's going to fund all of this additional spending, which then impacts on our ability to provide public services. And the number of over 70s, for example, is set to increase by 50% over the next 25 years, whereas the number of those under 70, which are those primarily in the working age population bracket, will increase by only 2%. And so our capacity to fund adequate levels of adult social care, children's social care, all these services that we rely on will really be dependent on our ability to live within our means and pay for the bill. And assuming we aren't able to provide the level of public service that is considered to be adequate or sufficient, that is going to translate to higher chronic issues related to either physical health or mental health. And those are issues that require more longer-term strategic thinking that are easy to overlook whilst we're in the middle of a crisis.
You touched briefly earlier on Brexit. So would you say that Brexit is going to be something that will substantially impact our ability to bounce back from the current situation? Is Brexit likely to be a substantial compounding factor?
Brexit is certainly going to be a compounding factor in the sense that we're in July now, but it was just 6 months ago that Brexit was driving the agenda for the UK, where a lot of public resources, a lot of mental bandwidth in terms of policy making space was diverted away from business as usual things to keep society running to Brexit related issues. And that required a lot of resources. It had in a substantial level of uncertainty related to, I mean, if we don't know where we are going today because of coronavirus, that same sentiment, if we rewind 6 months ago, was what the sentiment was across Whitehall and greater society as to, okay, where are we headed now? So when you bring those two events together, there is a potential risk for cataclysmic collision, where if we have a very hard Brexit, where we have basically no deal and we revert to trading agreements that are just WTO standard ones that any country within the WTO framework receives, that would be very, very negative, not just for immediate relationships that the UK has, but also for our longer-term structural ability to sustain economic growth. And then if you layer on that with second or subsequent waves of coronavirus, then that really would put public finances under considerable weight. I would say longer term risk, but that's not even longer term because that's in about 6 months' time. So I think we really need to keep the eye on the ball and make sure that prudent public financial management stays at the top of the dashboard, so to speak, so that we are able to weather these future types of negative shocks, which inevitably will manifest.
Some interesting nuggets there, Jeff. So thank you very much for joining us today. If you'd like to hear more on Jeff's thoughts, you will be able to find him on Twitter and links will be in the description below. Thank you very much for your time today, Jeff.
Thank you.
Always great to get the big picture macro perspective. Next up, we have Ileana Steccolini, Professor of Accounting at Essex Business School and member of SIPFA's International Advisory Panel. Now, for those of you who may have missed it, last month, SIPFA convened a global panel of experts to generate fresh insights into public sector finance issues worldwide. The panel includes more than 30 partners from across academia, international bodies, and professional accounting organisations. You'll be able to find more of their work on their LinkedIn showcase page. A link will be in the description below. Ileana joined us to discuss resilience in the public sector, the impact of the pandemic, and the resilience model she's developed through her own research.
So today we're joined by Ileana Steccolini, a professor of accounting at Essex Business School. Thanks for your time today, Ileana.
It's a pleasure.
So to dive right into today's conversation, can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you wanted to join the International Advisory Panel?
I am specifically interested in public sector accounting. And well, the interesting thing is that this was not necessarily what I wanted to do in my life. So I started, I wanted to be an auditor. So I studied because I really wanted to be an auditor. And then one day I took a module of public sector accounting and I discovered that actually there was a whole world of accounting which had to do with the public sector. And after that, I was asked whether I wanted to join Sdabocconi School of Management in Milan at the time where there was an enormous need for training people in the public sector in, let's say, more generally managerial techniques. But of course, there was an enormous need, especially in terms of, for example, training them in accruals accounting. So I joined the management school, specifically working on training, for example, CFOs in the Italian public sector to learn how to apply accruals accounting in their areas. And I also started to work on several projects with municipalities in doing this. And this is where my passion for the public sector came from, basically. So basically, from that moment on, I went on becoming more and more passionate about the roles which accounting can play in public services. And then at the same time, how public services really shape the ways in which you look at accounting. I found this truly fascinating. And yeah, I couldn't basically stop carrying out my research in that field. So I guess you may really understand why, of course, when I came to the to work in the UK almost 4 years ago. And after that, I really realized that SIPFA were the people I really wanted to start a dialogue with, because we share the same passion, I think. And at the same time, I really think that we have something else in common. One is the international perspective. I really love trying to make some changes, for example, in the Italian public sector. I really like the idea of working in the UK, but I also love the idea of being part of a network of people who are interested in public sector accounting in the world. And I think, again, SIPFA has a lot to do with this kind of attitude. The final thing that I share with SIPFA, but on this I am on the other side of the fence, is the fact that we are both working in trying to bridge the gap between academia and practice. Of course, on two different sides, but I think the point is on both sides we will meet at some point. So these are the reasons why I'm really proud, of course, of supporting SIPFA.
And some of our listeners may or may not be aware that you've been doing some recent research and work around resilience in public sector accounting. Given the current coronavirus pandemic, what are your thoughts on how COVID-19 has impacted organizational resilience, maybe in the UK or maybe internationally?
What I have noticed is that after the COVID-19 outbreak, there has been an increasing interest in resilience. This made me, let's say, smile a little bit, because actually, the problem with resilience has always been there, especially in the public sector. So I started to study resilience in the public sector, especially after the global financial crisis, because I wanted to understand better how to make the public sector organizations more resilient in the face of crisis and shocks more generally. So I really think the COVID-19 outbreak has just provided us with a good example of why it should have been important, actually, to be prepared for shocks before this happening. But I also think that what is interesting about this is actually that now many organizations, especially those which were in a way faced by the crisis in the strongest way, they are learning about the fact that the matter is not only facing this crisis. Well, the most, let's say, the most resilient ones are the ones that are saying, okay, we are coping with this crisis, but we need to be prepared for the next one. So I think the point about resilience is not only being prepared for one crisis, is taking this as an opportunity to be prepared for the next one. There is a lot of discussion about the next wave or the next pandemic. I think this is exactly what resilience is. It's not being prepared for one crisis. It's being prepared for the next two or three or four crises and continuously learning.
Can you tell us a little bit about the resilience model that you've developed and how the COVID-19 pandemic has kind of stress tested that model?
Oh, yes, of course. So as I said before, the model we developed around resilience was a model that we developed to look at how local governments internationally, so it was not only about Italy, Germany, Austria, France, or the UK, but also a wider number of countries, were facing the consequences of the global financial crisis, for example, most of all austerity. So in doing this, we tried to identify how they could be resilient. And in the beginning, you are very naive and you think, oh, there is one single way of being resilient. And actually, you discover that this is not true. You discover that actually every organization is resilient in its own way. It would have been very difficult, however, to develop a research thinking that every organization is different. So what we tried to do, actually, we identified typologies, patterns of resilience, for example, self-regulation, or more organizations which were resilient because they were continuously adapting, others which were transforming, so doing even more than simply adapting, and others which were simply buffering. So we identified different forms of resilience. And then we said, well, if we want also to be useful to them, we need to identify what are the dimensions which explain resilience. And after a lot of discussion and a lot of looking into the cases that we were considering, what we found out was that resilience was very much the result of a combination of anticipation and coping. So organizations needed the capacity to anticipate the crisis. And in this sense, if we think of COVID-19, anticipating COVID-19 for even countries, not only organizations, meant having the antenna to understand that actually what was happening was not a normal flu or a normal pneumonia, but was something different. And then, apart from anticipating, you also need to be prepared to face the crisis. So, for example, to have the capacity to face it. Of course, apart from the healthcare system, which is the most natural example, we may also think, for example, of the digital capacity. Many public sector organizations had to move completely from providing services in presence to services online. And actually, some of them had already the capacity for doing this because they had invested on this in the past. But some others, for example, due also to austerity, they had not the same capacities. So in a way, we found out that anticipatory capacities were central ensuring resilience. And for sure, COVID-19, we felt that really tested this model in the right sense. At the same time, of course, when the crisis struck, what you need to do is to make sure that you can cope with the crisis so that, for example, you can absorb it or, well, in a way, and also being able to get to the normal activities, which is one thing, or you may even have to change, as we said before, provided that you have the digital capacity, then you have also to adapt and transform your services in a different way. So again, we really felt that even if the model was developed before COVID-19, we really felt that the main dimensions that we identified were quite relevant also in the present crisis. However, what we really feel that is central in the model is what we called perceived vulnerability. That is, to understand how you can be resilient, you also need to understand whether, for example, people in an organization are aware of their vulnerabilities and they feel they can cope with them. And again, COVID-19 was really an interesting example of how the perceived vulnerability of organizations or even countries or systems affected the way in which they were responding to the crisis. I'm thinking of Greece, or I'm Italian, of Southern Italy. They were clearly aware, in some cases, they may have found it difficult to face the request, the demand for healthcare because of the COVID-19. So their responses were very much oriented towards trying to avoid the spread of the virus. In other cases where systems felt more reassured about their healthcare capacity, their perceived vulnerability, paradoxically, was of course lower. And then they were even slower in locking down cities or countries. And this is very interesting because it allows really to understand how it's not only a matter of capacities, but very much about how you make sense of things and how you evaluate your own vulnerabilities, which of course have clearly to do also with the accounting systems and the risk management of organizations.
So apart from the virus, what are some other potential shocks to organizations that could come out of the woodwork in the future? And then also, what are some of the key things that public organizations can do to strengthen their financial resilience?
I think this is the very important question. Sometimes we tend to focus only on, in a way, in solving the contingent problem. But actually, as an academic, I feel responsibility, let's say, for learning from what we are doing now for the future. So in this sense, I really think that actually we need to consider the serious possibility that there will be future crises. If we think also about the past, actually it is punctuated by continuous crises. And the point is that those crises systematically affect the public sector, because actually the public sector is where you go when you have a crisis. Public sector is often the one which has to buffer and absorb the crisis of whole systems. So this is really critical, especially in the public sector. Of course, there is a lot of discussion about the fact that this may not be the last pandemic. So we may need to be ready for future pandemics. But I think there are also the so-called slow burning crises, which are really important because actually sometimes they provide the basis for the outbreak of sudden crises in the future. What I am talking about is, for example, climate change. Since it is slow burning, everybody's talking about this, but then the real actions taken to face the possibility of future serious shocks and crises, I think is still low. So the number of actions is still limited. So I think definitely if we want to avoid future shocks, we need to work more into this and build the resilience around climate change, for example. The other two things that I have in mind are, first of all, we still need to consider social issues. So again, we may have currently slow-burning crises, which may erupt one day very significantly, because actually even COVID-19 has shown that inequalities are still very significant, and social equity should be a real worry. We also need to consider what happened also in the US recently with the Black Lives Matter movement. All of these events show that this is a slow-burning crisis. We are not considering inequalities or discrimination issues or social equity issues enough. And then one day they erupt suddenly. So I think if we did more in this respect, we could probably avoid having to face shocks suddenly. I'm thinking about the fact that this has clear repercussions for the ways in which we budget for the future. We need to budget more for these issues. I'm also thinking about specific forms of tools that actually can be used around, of course, around environmental sustainability. I'm thinking about gender budgeting or forms of budgeting which put more in evidence, for example, the role of inequalities. And the last thing that I have in mind is, of course, the fact that every time there are shocks, as we said, the public sector is very often the residual claimant. This means that when there is a crisis today, very often the public sector has to pay for it, has to absorb it. In a few years, this may also translate in problems, or not necessarily a few years, in a few months, this may translate in problems in terms of having the financial resources to continue providing services and to continue being there in case new crises erupt. This is the other type of crisis that we really need to be careful about. We saw what happened with the global financial crisis and austerity. We need to avoid this from happening again in the future. I think you also asked about what organizations and the public sector should be doing in this respect. Very shortly, in our experience, what we have observed, both interviewing people now during the COVID-19 situation, but also before when we were looking at more the shocks related to austerity, we felt that there were some dimensions which were particularly critical and important to build before a crisis. And those were, for example, critical thinking. People who can say, no, things are not working. We need to encourage people to point out whether there are problems or issues. The other thing is the role of digitalization, but also the role of social media. This is the other thing that in the public sector we should consider is increasingly important, because it has been shown that it is also central in fighting crises and shocks. The other final thing that I wanted to underline is the importance of shared information and collaboration. I don't think I need to refer to current issues happening in many countries where there is no shared information about data about COVID-19, but I think this shows really that shared information and prompt sharing of information is central during crises. And if you don't start this before the crisis, it is very difficult to establish during the crisis. Shared information, shared collaboration across the public sector and sectors is very important, and also the involvement of communities. The other thing that public sector organizations need to build on to prepare for crisis, because you cannot one day just decide that the community must be involved because there is a crisis. Involving communities required building trust over the years. And then you have that trust that is needed to face the crisis.
So it's not just, you know, this pandemic, potentially, you know, another different pandemic, you know, a different wave that comes in the future, but also it's social, environmental accountability and digital issues as well. And you're saying that collaboration is the key way that organizations can strengthen their resilience.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe in this strongly.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ileana.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Sip for Speaks, and that's about all we've got time for this week. Thanks again to both of our speakers for joining us, and we will see you next time.